Good morning. Finally, be strong in the Lord and in his mighty power. Put on the full armor of God so that you can take your stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. I'd like to focus this morning on the devil's schemes. Is it important to understand what the devil's schemes are? Could there be a reason why it might be important for us to understand what those are? Should it be something that we study? And I believe it is important, and I think Paul further goes on and agrees with that. In 2 Corinthians 2:11, he says, "In order that Satan might not outwit us, for we are not unaware of his schemes." It'd be unfortunate to not understand the way that the devil works and be unaware of his schemes. Because if we are unaware of his schemes, then he can outwit us and he can trap us. We need to be aware of the devil's schemes. And this morning I'd like to discuss what I think is his very favorite one. It doesn't take long before we start seeing some of the schemes of the devil. I'd like to go through several stories in the Old Testament. And we'll start, of course, in Genesis chapter 3, in the first six verses. We immediately see one of Satan's best tricks. It says, "Now the serpent was more crafty than any of the wild animals the Lord God had made. He said to the woman," and listen to what he said here. I think sometimes we miss this. "He said to the woman, 'Did God really say you must not eat from any tree in the garden?'" Did God really say that you can't eat from any tree in the garden? Now, did God say that? No, God didn't say anything like that, right? But this is the way the devil likes to work. And I know you've probably heard of other people talking about, you know, God is just the God of no. He creates all these wonderful things that we can be involved with, and then he says we can't use them. God doesn't do that. God provides us wonderful things for us to use, and he tells us how to use them. So he didn't say that you can't eat from any tree in the garden. God didn't create all these fruit-bearing trees and say, now you can't eat from any of them. But that's the way the devil asked the question to the woman. Did he really say that you can't eat from any tree in the garden? And so he's planning something right there in the mind of Eve. Devil's like, I know who God is. I know how he works. Did he really say that? And he knew that he didn't say that. The woman said to the serpent, "No, we may eat fruit from the trees in the garden. But God did say," she's starting to think now, "but God did say that you must not eat fruit from the tree that is in the middle of the garden, and you must not touch it, or you will die." And I don't know if that last part there, the not touch it, is true or not. Originally, when we first hear the command, we don't have that. It says you weren't supposed to eat of it. But whatever, maybe Eve did hear that. Maybe that's what God did tell her, that you are not supposed to touch it either. But she definitely knew what the rule was. There's just this one tree. And the devil says what? "You will not surely die." He changes one word. "You will not surely die," the serpent said to the woman, "for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened," which is true. "And you will be like God, knowing good and evil," which is true. He just had one little lie in there, didn't he? "You will not surely die." And even that is kind of subject, because did they die immediately? No, they didn't. But did death come into the world through this action? Yes, it did. God was truthful when he said this, and the devil was lying. "And when the woman saw the fruit of the tree was good for food," it was good for food, "it was pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, she took some and ate it." It was good. It looked probably a lot like the other fruits on the other trees. There's just one difference between that tree and all the other trees, really. It's just that you weren't supposed to have that one. It was the one that was forbidden. And so the devil made it seem like there must be something really good about this. You should try this. And so he changes one little thing. He says, "You will not surely die." One little lie. And this is, I believe, Satan's best trick. His best trick is counterfeiting. We try to make something We present something, an option to you that looks like the real thing. It looks very good. Sometimes it even looks better than what you're supposed to have. But there's no truth in it. It's completely fake. It's a lie. This is what God, this is what the devil does. He counterfeits things. It's fake. It looks great, but literally the devil is in the details. You need to look at the details of what is being presented to you, because that is where the devil resides. He doesn't get most of us on blatant sin, does he? I mean, we don't have a whole lot of murder. You know, probably don't know a whole lot of people, mass murderers, or maybe even pedophiles, or things that we consider to be real blatant sin. Blatant sin, really, to humans, is somewhat unpalatable. Not to all. But to most of us, it's something like, I can't understand why anybody would do something like that. Blatant sin, the devil knows he doesn't quite get us on that as easily as he can get us on those little things. Those little things. If I can just present something here that's not from God, but make it look very similar to what is from God, and you go with that, then I have you, because you're not doing what God wanted, and therefore you're lost. And it might seem like a very simple thing, but this is the way the devil knows he can get us. He counterfeits things. He changes one little word, not die. Let's go to Genesis chapter 4, verses 2 through 7. We don't have to go very many chapters before we can keep seeing this same theme. Genesis 4, 2 through 7. Later she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now Abel kept flocks and Cain worked the soil. In the course of time, Cain brought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord. That sounds like a good thing. But Abel brought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his flock. The Lord looked with favor on Abel and his offering, but on Cain and his offering he did not look with favor. So Cain was very angry and his face was downcast. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why is your face downcast? If you do what is right, will you not be accepted? But if you do not do what is right, sin is crouching at your door. It desires to have you, but you must master it." What was the difference between these two? It was the exact same time, right? In the course of time, they both came. So they did this at the same time. It looks like they did it at the same place. They both brought an offering to God. They both wanted to worship God. They both, I think, brought the best of what they had to offer. So isn't that all good? Isn't that all acceptable? Well, we know if we read in Hebrews that it was by faith Abel offered his sacrifice, and faith cometh by hearing the word of God. So we know that God had told them what is expected. It had been very easy for Cain to take the best of his offering, the fruits, the vegetables, and buy a lamb from his brother Abel to offer. And he would have been accepted. This is what God expected. It was in the details. It was in the details. There's something that God told them to do, and one little detail, if you don't follow God, is the one that can make you feel like you're doing the right thing. Cain was very upset. Felt like he was doing the right thing, but the devil got him. The devil worked on him, right? It was crouching at the door, God says. And if you're not careful, he'll get you. He'll get you. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 12. This is when Jeroboam, Judah and Israel had just been separated, and Jeroboam was in charge of the northern tribes, which was Israel, right? But where is the place of worship? Where is the place of worship? Jerusalem, right? Where's Jerusalem? Is it in Israel? At this time? No, it's in Judah. It's down south. And so Jeroboam has taken over the northern 10 tribes of Israel. And he's worried because he knows that God has told them that the proper way to worship is to go to Jerusalem at a certain time, at a certain festival, to offer certain sacrifices in a certain way. God has laid out all of these details. And if we look at, chapter 12, verse 26, starting with verse 26. This is really good. It starts out saying, Jeroboam thought to himself. That's a problem when you think to yourself. Okay? You need to be thinking about what God wants you to do. But Jeroboam thought to himself, which means the devil is probably helping him out here. The kingdom will now likely revert to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifice, and they go up because Jerusalem is higher elevation, if these people go up to offer sacrifices at the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, they will again give their allegiance to their Lord, Rehoboam, king of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Rehoboam. After seeking advice, really bad advice, the king made two golden calves. He said to the people, "It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt. One he set up in Bethel, which is down the very south part of Israel, right on the border, right across the border from Jerusalem, right on the way down to Jerusalem. Here's a really convenient spot, Bethel. And then he put one he set up in Bethel, and the other he set up in Dan, right up here at the far north extreme. Okay, so they can go all this way, but there's where they need to stop, those two places. Jeroboam built shrines on high places and appointed priests from all sorts of people, even though they were not Levites. He instituted a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the festival held in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altar. This he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves he had made. And at Bethel he also installed priests at the high places he had made. On the 15th day of the 8th month, a month of his own choosing, he offered sacrifices on the altar he had built at Bethel. So he instituted the festival for the Israelites and went up to the altar to make offerings. He did something similar, didn't he? He did worship, same festival time, and he didn't even tell, did you ever realize in this story, he didn't even tell them they couldn't go to Jerusalem, did he? He didn't tell them they can't go to Jerusalem. He said, it's too much for you. Here's an easier way to worship. Here's an easier way. Let's do it this way. And it was all, not because Jeroboam had any, wanted to make it easier for him or wanted to have any worship or scriptural meaning at all. It was all about keeping his kingdom. That was the whole point of it. There was nothing there. And Jeroboam understood that this is how you did it because the devil was working with him. He says, don't make it obvious. Make it really similar and just change a little thing so that they are not doing what God has warned them to do. Let's look at 2 Samuel chapter 6. 2 Samuel chapter 6. And I think you know this story, but I'll just read just one verse. I'll read verse 3. 2 Samuel 6:3. They set the ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart. Now, what happens at the end of this story? Is it supposed to be on a new cart? It's a brand new, very well built, beautiful, probably, cart that the ark was going to be brought in on. What's wrong with that? Isn't that amazing? What's wrong with that? That's not the way they were supposed to carry the ark. There were specific rules on how they were supposed to carry the ark with the rods that went through the loops, right? They're supposed to carry the ark that way. They were always supposed to do that. They decided to do something just a little different. Let's build a new cart. A brand new, beautiful cart that we can just pull with oxen and the oxen can do the work for us and the cart will just go along and the ark will be there and everybody will be able to see it. And how's this story end? What happens? Uzzah was killed because he tried to do what? He tried to steady the ark. And a lot of times we read that story and we think, oh, poor Uzzah. Right? Poor Uzzah. Uzzah was right there with everybody else. He knew the rules. And he knew that they had built a brand new ark, a cart. He might have even helped them build this new cart. That's not what was supposed to happen. When the oxen stumbled and the ark began to fall, Uzzah tried to stable it and was struck down dead. Just because they tried to do something that looked really good, like they were really doing something for God, but it wasn't what God had asked. It was counterfeit. It was fake. It wasn't the truth. 2 Kings chapter 5. This is the story about Naaman. Naaman was a commander of the Syrian army, and what did he get? He got leprosy, right? And people said, hey, you know, you can go to Elisha, and he's a prophet of God, and he can probably do something for you. And Naaman, even though he's a great, powerful man, actually went. When you have leprosy, you're pretty desperate. You want to get this fixed. So in 2 Kings chapter 5, I'll start in verse 11. This is right after Elisha has just told him what he is to do. What was he supposed to do? What was Naaman supposed to do? In what river? Jordan. And dip seven times, right? In the Jordan, dip seven times, and your leprosy will be gone. Now, leprosy, I would imagine, is pretty bad. And this is what you're being asked to do. He didn't ask him to pay $1 million. He didn't ask him to give up all his power, to not be the commander of the Syrian army anymore. He said, go into this river right here and dip down seven times and you'll be clean. And how did Naaman react in verse 11? But Naaman went away angry and said, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than any of these waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed? So he turned and went off in a rage. And Naaman's servants went to him and said, now here's some good advice. My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more than when he tells you wash and be cleansed? What he's asking you is really, really easy. I mean, we could have had to spend millions of dollars on this, and he's asking you just to dip down the river seven times and you're being cleansed. If he would have asked you to do something amazing, you would have done it. That's why we came the whole way here. These were good servants. So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan seven times as the man of God had told him. And his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. God asks us to do certain things. And there are other ways that we think that we should do it. There's better rivers. There's better things that it seems like we should do. That's our wisdom. And it's counterfeit. It's fake. If it's not the truth, if it's not God, the way he wants us to do it, then it's not the right way to do it. When we went to Colorado when I was young, we went across the Royal Gorge Bridge, a tiny little bridge over this river that long ways down. Now, there's multiple paths across that bridge you could take. I liked taking the one that put me as far away from either edge as possible. Right down the middle, that's a good path to take. The devil says, there's a whole bunch of paths. What about this one right here? Right here on the edge. Look at the view. Look at the view. Take this path here. That's a dangerous path to be on when you're walking across that bridge, right there on the edge. It's a very dangerous path. Remember in the temptation of Jesus? Two of the times that Jesus was tempted, the devil took him places. Where'd he take him? Highest pinnacle in the temple, and the next one he took him up the top of a mountaintop, right? These are dangerous places to be. And the devil said, look at everything. Look at everything. Follow me, and I'll give you all of this. This is what the devil does. He takes us out there on the edge and says, look at the view. And the problem is, sometimes we follow him. We follow that counterfeit, fake path. And as soon as we decide to follow him, where does he go? He goes right off the bridge. He jumps off the bridge, and we follow him. That's what happens. We fall, just like he fell. This is the path that he has. It looks so great. And as soon as you decide to follow him, you realize he just went right off the bridge, and you follow him right with him. And this is not a good thing. I've mentioned this before, but 99.9% of all rat poison is what? Good rat food, right? Delicious, whatever that food is very good. The 0.1% is what? It's poison. That's where the devil is. The devil is in those details. He's in that 0.1%. where everything else looks like normal, good rat food. It looks the same, but it's not what we're supposed to take. It's not what we're supposed to take. And the devil gets us in those details. There are many paths to God. Are there many paths to God? We hear this so much, don't we? There are many paths to God. Well, there's many paths, but there's not many paths to God. Jesus himself says, I am the way. I am the way. There's only one path to God. But there are many paths. It's like a maze. I hated mazes. I just never really liked them. You go along a long, long ways and you come to a dead end and it's like, and you gotta start all over. I just really despised the mazes. And that's kinda what it is like for us. There's one path. There's only one path. But the devil does what? He turns it into a maze. He puts all these other counterfeit paths there. He tries to trick us. He tries to shed light on alternative paths, but he's actually crouching there in the darkness, ready to spring on us. Matthew 7:13 says, broad is the way that leads to destruction. So there are other paths, and they look good. They look wide. We can all go on this one. Look at this one. This one's paved. This is a great path right here. But broad is the way and easy is the way that can lead to destruction. There's multiple paths, but there's only one true path to God. I'd like to just talk a little bit about this light and darkness. It's really interesting. This is what the devil does. He shines light on things. He shines light on parts of things that makes it look like it's really, really good. But there's parts that he leaves in the shadows, in the darkness, and that's where he is hiding there. Just like someone who's trying to trap you, waiting for you to go right there into that light, and he can then jump on you and get you. And I was kind of doing a word count. You can go to some databases and put in words in the Bible and see how many times it is in various translations. And I was using the King James because I know that's what a lot of you like to use. So I put in the word devil. And the devil in the King James Version is found 57 times. 57 times. If you put in the word Satan, you find it 49 times. If you put in Beelzebub or Belial, I put in both of them kind of at the same time, and you find it 23 times. If you put in the Prince of Darkness in the King James, how many times do you think you find it? You never find it. The Prince of Darkness isn't in there. The closest I could ever come to it was actually the very first word I read when I got up here in Ephesians 6:12. It says, "For we wrestle not against the flesh and the blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world." That's the only place I could come to it. It's really kind of ironic and weird how sometimes we use a lot of phrases and things and names that actually are not technically in the Bible in that way. We don't find the prince of darkness. I did find the God of this age in 2 Corinthians 4:4, which referred to the devil, the God of this age, and also the prince of the power of air in Ephesians 2:2. And sometimes we kind of take some of those pieces together and we put them all together and we get the prince of darkness, and then we don't realize that basically we've heard that in movies a lot of places is where it kind of comes from. Then I also did a search on Lucifer. How many times is that in the King James? Everybody, no one wants to guess now. They're all afraid. One time, but that's only the King James. If you use any other version, you'll never find the word Lucifer in the Bible. It's only one time in the King James. I want to look at that real quick here. Isaiah chapter 14. And I'm going to read 3 through 16 so we get the whole idea. All of Isaiah 13 was about the fall of Babylon, the end of Babylon. We're talking about the fall of the Babylonian king here. So when we get to Isaiah 14, it says on verse 3, this is from Isaiah, it says, On the day the Lord gives you relief from suffering and turmoil and cruel bondage, you will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. Here's the taunt you will take up. And then he gives us the taunt. Not that we should probably taunting people, but that's what he gives us here. He gives us a taunt. And so here's what the taunt says. How the oppressor has come to an end. How his fury has ended. This is the Babylonian king. The Lord has broken the rod of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers, which in anger struck down peoples with unceasing blows, and in fury subdued nations with relentless aggression. All the lands are at rest and at peace. They break into singing. Even the pine trees and the cedars of Lebanon exult over you and say, now that you have been laid low, no woodsman comes to cut us down. The grave below is all astir to meet you at your coming. It rouses the spirits of the departed to greet you, all those who were leaders in the world. It makes them rise from their thrones, all those who are kings over the nations. They will all respond, and they will say to you, you also have become weak as we are. You have become like us. All your pomp has been brought down to the grave, along with the noise of your harps. Maggots are spread out beneath you, and worms cover you. How you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of the dawn. I'm reading in the NIV. So we don't have Lucifer. But if you're in the King James right there, it says, O Lucifer. In the NIV and all the other translations, it talks about the morning star, which is what, by the way? What planet? It's not even a star, it's what? It's Venus, right? Venus is the morning star. It's not actually a star, it's a planet, but it comes up in the morning. You see it's very bright, and it means that light is coming. And so what we have here is it says, O morning star, son of dawn, you have been cast down. You are not what you thought you were, the bearer of light, this morning star. You have been cast down, who was once laid low of the nations. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I will sit enthroned on the mount of assembly on the utmost heights of the sacred mountain. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to the grave, to the depths of the pit. Those who see you stare at you, they ponder your fate. Is this the man who shook the earth and made kingdoms tremble? Now, who are we talking about there? Well, we're talking about a Babylonian king, most definitely. Now, could there be some allusion to the devil there? Probably. We have a lot of chapters in Isaiah that refer to certain individual humans, but also could refer to, like, Jesus, or in this case, refer to the devil. But the problem is with the translation there is Lucifer is a literal translation. Lucifer, in Roman times, in Latin, meant Venus. It meant the bright star. And so Isaiah didn't ever say Lucifer here. He referred to the morning star. But the King James Version was based, the translation, we talked about this morning a little bit with translations, the King James translation was based off of the Latin Vulgate, which was written about 400 years after Christ by Jerome. And so it had Roman terms in it. And so when the King James translated it, he translated as really the literal, what the Roman Latin term for Venus, the morning star, was. And it was Lucifer. Well, once it got put in the King James translation, then, it solidified it as really a name for Satan. But it's incredibly ironic. Isn't it incredibly ironic? What does Lucifer mean? It means the morning star, the bearer of light. And when we call him Lucifer, then, it's kind of a problem, because in most of the scriptures, what is the morning star? Who is the morning star? Jesus is the morning star, right? We have it in Revelation 22:16. If you want to look that up, he calls himself, I am the morning star. In 2 Peter 1:19, we have a reference to Jesus being the morning star. He is the bearer of light. He is the morning star. What does it say here? It says, O morning star. This is a taunt, isn't it? O morning star, great giver of the light, how you have fallen. You're not the morning star. You're not the morning star. You're not actually Lucifer, really, by the very definition of what the word means. But we still use this term. Lucifer means light giver. But this is very ironic, because this is what the devil does. He pretends to be Lucifer. He pretends to be the light bearer. He shines light on things that makes it look really, really good. But he's hiding in the darkness to pounce. The 2-week meeting, I did some science demonstrations, and I'm going to repeat one of those for you today if you didn't get to see it. And let's see here. Ginger, this is going to be a 10-minute lesson. You guys hot? put on the side there. Okay, you want to hit the lights there. Okay, so here we have a fan and it's going around really fast. And in physics, what we do a lot of times is we use strobe lights. So what we do with the strobe lights is we can actually kind of slow, it seems like, we play with light. We kind of slow things down. Because this fan blade is going around a certain amount of times per second, a certain amount of rotations. And if we can match the frequency of this with the kind of the amount of times it's going around, then I can illuminate it, right, when the fan blade is like straight up, we'll say, and then the strobe goes off. And what does the fan blade do? Goes around, and you can't see that. And then it flashes again, and where is the strobe light? Where's the fan blade, I mean? It's right in the same place. So what does it make it look like? It makes it look like it's not even moving, right? So we're going to try to, if we can get this to work, we'll try to demonstrate that. And there we go. And see, I can be very tricky with the darkness. I'm not really being tricky with the light. I'm being tricky with the darkness. I'm trying to not show you some things. And I can kind of make the fan blade look like it's going forward. And I can stop it. And then make it look like it's going backwards. And I can make you think that there's a lot of things going on. I can make you believe stuff with the darkness. And when you have it kind of really stopped, really, if I get to stop really good, it's almost mesmerizing, isn't it? Kind of makes you feel like you could just put your fingers in there and touch that thing, doesn't it? Now what happens if you put your fingers in there and touch that blade? Your fingers are going to be cut off, right? Because that blade's actually going around there and it's very, very dangerous. It's very dangerous. That's where the devil is. He's saying, look at it. Look at it. Reach out. Reach out. Take that fruit. Touch it. Go ahead. It's perfectly safe. It looks great. And as soon as you do, the devil has you. And he can destroy you. It's very important to understand this concept of the devil's schemes. Or you can get the lights. Thanks.
Second Corinthians 11:13 through 55. 2 Corinthians 13, or 11, 13 through 55. For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, masquerading as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for Satan himself masquerades as an angel of light. We even use the term Lucifer. We still use it for him. That means the light bearer. But he's masquerading as that. He's not really that. He really is a ruler of darkness. That's where he hides. That's where he gets us. The devil is prowling in the darkness of the details. That's where he is. John 8:44, Jesus himself, in referring to some of the people that were following the devil, says, you belong to your father, the devil, and you want to carry out your father's desire. He was a murderer from the beginning, not holding to the truth, for there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks his native language, for he is a liar and the father of lies. That's our Savior speaking right there. Not very nice words, is it? He is a liar and the father of lies. And when you follow him, you are doing the same thing. You are trying to trap other people. We had, I thought, a really good message in our Labor Day meeting that talked about the FBI doesn't really need to know what all the other counterfeit bills look like, do they? The FBI needs to know what? He knows what. They need to know what the real one looks like. What is the truth? If we know what the real one looks like, then we will not follow these other paths. Jesus Christ is that real one. Jesus Christ is the truth. And when he left this world, he explicitly gave a commandment. The last thing he did when he left this world, he gave explicitly a commandment. Go forth and baptize all disciples, all nations, in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Right? This is the commandment he gave. How quickly did we try to change that? How quickly did that try to get changed? This was the commandment. that Jesus said. And not only that, a lot of times we stop right there. At the end of that verse, he says, and to do all things that I command you. Not just this one thing that I've commanded you, which is pretty important, because he singled it out, but to do all things that I command you. And why should we do that? Well, the first part of the verse says, I have now received all authority on earth and in heaven. Jesus has received all authority. He is the truth. We need to follow him. Do everything that he has commanded you. And one of those things is to be baptized in his name. We ask that you take care of that as we stand and sing the invitation song.